Hello and welcome to The Stack. This week we speak to the founders of wine publication Noble Rot. I visit Dan in their brand new restaurant in London's Soho. We also speak with Ernie Gates from military newspaper Stars and Stripes and James Andrew from football magazine 442. Stay tuned. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis, and I am Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Coming up on the show, we talk about Stars and Stripes, the renowned military paper that was recently threatened to close in the US. Plus, as sports return, we speak to James Andrew from football title 442. But first, I had the pleasure to visit Noble Rot's new venture, a restaurant in London's Greek Street, same location of the late iconic Gay Hussar. Noble Rot is also a wine publication with cheeky covers and interesting stories surrounding the world of wine and food. I spoke to the founders Dan Keeling and Mark Andrew.
Greek Street, yeah, I mean, we've been coming to Greek Street for many years, whether that was to the Astoria, which is no longer with us, which is just around the corner, so many other restaurants, the French House down the road, the pub. So it's always been an area close to our heart. And when the opportunity to, you know, work with or take over the lease on the Gay Hussar came up, it was just something that was too good to miss, basically. So, iconic restaurants, there's not that many left in London. This is one of its greatest in terms of its clientele, its history. So it was something that we just couldn't refuse.
And Mark, for those who know already your other restaurant on Lamb's Conduit Street, what can people expect? Is it kind of, I'm sure it's the same quality, but what is kind of different from the Greek Street one?
We certainly want Greek Street to be have its own personality, and as much as we've loved what we've done with Lamb's Conduit Street and enjoyed developing the menu there and so on, we want to make sure that Greek Street has a nod to its past. So the Gay Hussar, you know, there'll be dishes on the menu that reference that. But at the same time, our head chef, Alex Jackson, has got a wonderful CV in terms of cooking Southern French, Provençal and Northern Italian food, and that really fits with our kind of wine-friendly ethos. So we'll be... It'd be sort of the second album from the same artist kind of thing. There'll be lots of familiarity for people who come from having visited Lamb's Conduit Street to the Greek Street restaurant. But at the same time, it will stand on its own and it will have its own personality too.
Amazing. And Daniel, of course, I had a sneak peek at the menu. I mean, besides excellent food, I mean, the wine list, that's impressive. And that's what you guys also known for. Again, similar types of wines that you have in the other restaurant as well.
Yeah, our biggest seller at Lamb's Conduit Street is Burgundy, and that's really our kind of greatest love. I mean, we love Rhone, we love Bordeaux, we love a lot of Spanish wine, we love Italian wine. So it's diverse. I mean, to be honest, I say diverse, but we don't have a lot of New World wine on the list. It's just kind of what we love. Also, a lot of classics, you know, Grand Crus from Vern Romani, but also at the same time, we have a lot of up-and-coming producers working in more natural kind of wine areas. So we don't kind of discriminate against any particular style. We just like the best of each. So it's going to be a continuation of Lamb's Conduit Street, but there'll be bottles here that won't be our other site and vice versa. We, you know, continue to search out stuff that other restaurants either don't spend the time looking for or don't have the kind of will to do it, but, you know, we do. So that's kind of what we can offer people.
And Mark, I need to ask as well, it's challenging, you know, in this climate, you know, the restaurant scene and everything. Were you guys worried? I mean, or you know, or how do you feel? Do you feel kind of we're past the worst? Of course, during lockdown, I mean, everyone had to be closed, right, in a way.
Yeah, it's difficult to say, isn't it? There's so many things that are unknowns that are out there. But from our perspective, we try and focus on the things we do have control over. So, you know, we're both by nature really positive people. We've got a team full of people who are very excited to be part of this restaurant opening. And, you know, we share the concerns that everybody has, you know, for people's health and safety, and also from an economic perspective, you know, the way things could go one direction or another. But we try not to dwell too much on the things that we can't have any control over, and we've just focused on making sure that we can we can make Noble Rot as good as it can be and as welcoming as it can be and as safe as it can be for the people who come to share their evening with us.
Well, that's a good way of thinking, I think. Daniel, besides the new restaurant, you guys also have a new book coming out, plus the magazine. You guys are busy, yeah?
Yeah. So it's been a couple of years in the making. It's coming out on Quadrille, part of Hardy Grant Books, out on the 29th of October. And really, I hate to use the word journey, but it's a journey. And it's kind of our wine journey from when we first met and we were both really just getting into wine, started drinking together and educating ourselves by drinking our way around the great kind of wine regions of Europe. But, you know, meeting the best producers as well. So the book is separated into two halves. And the first half of the book is really about how we met, starting a magazine, you know, how do you start a magazine? And, you know, we didn't have a clue at the beginning. Then how do you start a restaurant? And then it goes into kind of themes such as how do you order off a restaurant wine list? How do you taste wine? How do you judge it? How can you talk about it? You know, then it's, you know, greatest wine lists of the world, stuff like that.
It's true. You know what I do? Sometimes I keep it safe with that one wine. So it's very hard to explore a newer wine. So maybe I should read, you know, your articles on Noble Rot as well. Yeah. So you both didn't have a background in making magazines before you launched Noble Rot.
No, Dan's background was in the music industry and my background was in the wine trade. And, you know, we both, as Dan said, we both bonded through drinking great bottles together, and before long we were travelling the wine regions of Europe together. And it was out of that and out of our sort of shared we were a bit concerned about the fact that there wasn't anything out there in terms of wine media that we felt spoke to us in our language, the way that we communicated about wine. And so we resolved to put it right, and we didn't have a great deal of experience, and the wine magazine side of things was new to us, but it was a DIY project initially, which, thanks to, you know, to us learning on the job, but also very importantly having and meeting people that we could call on to help us with things like design and layout, and then over the years accumulating and accruing more fantastic contributors, whether they be the illustrators, the photographers, and obviously the writers. And so it's come a long way, I think, since the first issue. We've come a long way in 20 odd issues, and we're really excited about where we can take it in the future.
Remind us, what is the latest issue? I can see it's the one with the pink over, right?
This one was written by contributors in lockdown. So the front cover says, if not now, when? It's this idea of, you know, people have these really special bottles, but they kind of save them because they always think they're going to have a really special occasion to open them, someone's birthday and anniversary. But it's just a kind of reminder that life doesn't work like that, and you should celebrate life while you can and drink the bottles while you can. So we had some of our contributors writing that. We didn't have a chance to interview a bigger guest for it because everybody was in lockdown. But we did have Giorgio Locatelli, a little profile written about him by Faye Mashler. Yeah, I can't really remember what else.
Well, and talking about celebration, I mean, which wine would you choose then to celebrate the opening of here? I mean, give me any mini tips.
I'd probably be Grower's Champagne, Oulès Collan, something that's very dear to our hearts, a producer that we import from a little town called Congy in the south of Champagne, makes fabulous wine. I think we'd probably toast the opening of this place to that.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah, I mean, it might to some people sound like a cliche to celebrate with champagne, but when the champagne's as good as the likes of Ulysse Collan, then, you know, just opening the bottle is enough to celebrate in itself.
And finally, just for our listeners to understand, it's a really, really beautiful space. And also, you were mentioning you have a dining room as well. Is it true that there's a cartoon there, right?
Interesting. On these walls here, Martin Rosen, who's a Guardian political cartoonist, he would draw pictures of MPs that would come in portraits, and he would be paid in a meal by the owners. So all along this wall was portraits. They were taken by the previous landlords, so I don't know what's happening quite with that, but there's rumours that they might be donated by them to the National Portrait Gallery. But we really wanted to get Martin involved in the project, so we started talking to him. And upstairs on the first floor, we've called it the Rosen Suite because he's done two triptychs, one looking north up of Greek Street and one looking south. and it's got historical characters and also present day characters in there. So from Charles Dickens to, you know, Nigella or, you know, Diana Henry. So it's they're brilliant, brilliant pictures.
That was Dan Keeling and Mark Andrew there. Noble Rot in Greek Street is open now, and the magazine issue 23 is also out. Stars and Stripes is an American military newspaper founded in 1861. The main purpose of the paper is to cover relevant stories for members of the United States Armed Forces. More recently, the US government threatened to cut funds for the title, but thankfully, the decision has been reversed. I spoke with Stars and Stripes ombudsman Ernie Gates.
The format is, as a tabloid newspaper, it has general news, news from the states, news of the world, even news state by state here, plus conventional features like comics and entertainment and sports. So it looks like a tabloid style American newspaper, but it is published, you're right, mostly overseas to serve troops and their families that are deployed and deployed civilians as well.
Is it kind of a daily newspaper or a weekly one?
It's 7 days a week in places that are, they think of as downrange, that is places of conflict, whether it's Afghanistan or Syria, the Horn of Africa, the Persian Gulf. Those places have, frankly, more of a need for a printed paper than you would find in Britain or Germany or Japan, where there's access to other kinds of news. When you're downrange in Afghanistan, having a newspaper that's basically an American-style newspaper is a really welcome bit of home.
And I can imagine the importance of this for people in combat as well, because, you know, they need to read the news. And I'm sure, as you mentioned, there's also comics, so there's also kind of some light relief as well. So I can totally understand the importance for people, especially people in combat overseas for the U.S.
That's really true. And it's easy to see how the paper is just picked up quickly in places like that. But there's also a great need for simply independent news coverage, even in places where there are bases, where there's good internet access or there's other alternative sources of information. Stars and Stripes has reporters on bases all over the world, in places that, to be honest, other news organizations don't have much reason to be and certainly couldn't make a profit being. So Stars and Stripes has reporters in Okinawa, in Japan, in Korea, in Germany, England, plus all of these more conflict-oriented areas. And they do reporting on bases, on stories that otherwise would go unreported. And a lot of it in the past months has been related to the pandemic restrictions or pandemic news. And Stars and Stripes has credibility because it's independent. It has credibility beyond what the commander on the base might be saying. And that's the essential element of Stars and Stripes journalism.
Well, and you have a tough job because you're the man who needs to kind of defend its independence, right? Tell us a bit more about your job in particular.
Sure. My job has two threads, really. One is the conventional idea of the ombudsman as the reader's representative, as the person who is holding the newsroom accountable to perform its job according to the standards of journalism, accuracy, fairness, completeness, independence above all, impartiality. That's a conventional ombudsman job. The other half of my job, though, is to defend the independence of that newsroom from interference by commanders or interference by the Pentagon, which is what we have seen in the past 9 months. And that part of the job means that I do defend the ability of the newsroom to do its job. In this case, this year, the administration made a move to shut down Stars and Stripes by taking out its subsidy from the defense budget. This happened back in February. And just to round that out, the revenue for Stars and Stripes, about half of it comes from the defense budget. The other half comes from normal revenue sources, advertising, sales, subscriptions, and so on. But the administration was simply going to shut it down at the end of this month, actually, would have been its last day of publication. And then the organization would just have been dissolved by the end of January coming. So I have spent a lot of time with partners who are mostly retired news executives from around the country, trying to get Congress to reverse that decision. I believe we've actually come very close to succeeding as of this week. And at least the shutdown order has been rescinded. So Stars and Stripes will continue to publish. And I think it will continue to publish for a long time to come.
Well, and that's excellent. And that just proves, you know, the necessity of a newspaper like this. And Ernie, just a quick question. I know that the paper is more, you know, for the troops, for people in combat, but you mentioned their subscriptions. A civilian, is it okay? Can they actually subscribe to the newspaper?
Sure, and many do, especially, you know, it is a newspaper, and the print version of the paper is important in places where news is hard to come by. There are probably a dozen, 13, 14 separate print sites popped up around the world. But it's also a contemporary news organization. So it's 100% digital as well. It's a website. It's got e-newsletters. It has its own podcast. It operates for a mobile app and so on. It has all the ordinary contemporary extensions that you would expect of a news organization. So certainly civilians do subscribe. Especially online. The digital subscriptions are way up. Veterans, I think, in particular, or people who have been overseas and want to keep track of what's going on where they've been, are a big audience.
Ernie, I was going to ask you a question. Of course, there's the election is coming out in about, you know, 2 months from now. Can the paper have an opinion, or does it have to really be impartial? I have a feeling it must be impartial, right?
What a perfect question, Fernando. In fact, the organizing regulations for Stars and Stripes forbid it to take editorial stands of its own. So there are no editorials as such by Stars and Stripes staff. It does provide opinion in the form of syndicated columns, letters, and so on. And it's very carefully impartial and tries to make sure that those opinions don't tilt one way or the other over time. That's another element of my job as the ombudsman in terms of measuring the newsroom's performance. I look closely at the opinion pages to see how are they doing on that score. Are they in fact being impartial and presenting different points of view?
Ernie, for how long have you been working there at Stars and Stripes? And if it is a long time, have you noticed any changes in the paper?
This job is a term job, which means it's designed to expire after 3 years, and I would have a successor. The point of that is so that I don't need to have allies in the management or allies anywhere else. But it allows me to be independent and impartial and stand between without taking sides. So this is my second round in this job. I did it between 2012 and 2016. Then there was a gap where I had a successor, and then the job became open again. And I thought, I enjoyed that. I believe in the mission. Let me see if they will pick me up again. And they did. So in terms of changes, the most important change, I think, is the same one that's affected news organizations everywhere, which is the conversion from print to digital that's happened over the past 25 years and is accelerating. And new extensions on social media and so on become ever more important. Likewise, the economy of print to digital has had its impact on Stars and Stripes in terms of advertising revenue and so on. All of the same trends you would find in news everywhere else are affecting the economy of, or the economics of, Stars and Stripes. I think the newsroom, as I have looked at it, is really admirably independent. Its culture is independent. Its culture is professional. Even in this period this year where their existence has been in question, they've been dedicated, had their heads down, doing good work. doing work that, like, as I say, would not, these are stories that would not be reported otherwise.
That was Ernie Gates from Stars and Stripes. And finally on the show, as sports is slowly getting back to normal, I've asked James Andrew from football magazine 442 how he produced a sports magazine during lockdown. And I also ask about the importance of football magazines. Here is James with more.
So if we go back to, I guess, March time, and we were starting to look ahead to the European Championships, which was obviously the big football tournament that was supposed to be happening this summer, and we had a lot of plans and a lot of things already in place for issues that we were going to do in the lead up to that, and we'd done a lot of planning and we had to rip that up almost overnight. Something I guess that worked in our favour was that we found out, for you know, that the Euros were called off quite quickly into lockdown, so we weren't waiting to the last minute, but you know, all our plans just had to be almost ripped up, and then we had to just sort of reset and start again. And we got together as a team, and we just sort of, we didn't know how long this would last, and we just discussed ideas that we thought would work. And the great thing about football is, I mean, while no football was being played, football has been played for hundreds of years, and there are a lot of stories to tell. So we were able to pick on certain topics or times or countries or things that we wanted to focus on, and we did a lot of sort of issues based on, we did one on managers, the greatest managers of all time, we did one on the decade of the noughties, and as you mentioned, we did a Brazil one. So they were actually really good fun to do, and actually they've sold pretty well as well, so I've got no complaints. I mean, obviously it'd be better if the Euros had gone ahead and football was still going ahead and or was going ahead at the time, and we weren't in this period, but it wasn't terrible. Let's put it that way, and it was actually quite good fun once we knew what we were going to do and coming up with new ideas.
Well, and I completely agree with you, and I think one of the kind of advantages of 442 compared to, you know, the daily football coverage in the newspapers is that you guys are allowed to be a little bit more featurey in a way. And as you say, football has so many amazing stories, you know. So I think even the magazine, it's never been only about, you know, just results or just kind of, you know, there's always a little bit of a story here and there, right?
Yes, I mean, absolutely. I mean, we go to press about 10 days before we're in the shop. So we can't really be doing breaking news or big sort of news related stories because there's a very good chance it'll be out of date by the time we come out. So we have to be careful in that respect. I mean, we've just done a couple of weeks ago, we did the season preview issue, which is still out now. And that was very challenging in the sense that, you know, you need the information to be as up to date as possible. But, you know, you've got this sort of 7 to 10 day period where the magazine's left us and it's with the printers, and you don't know whether or not somebody's going to sign for somebody or someone you've talked about has left a club or joined another club. So on the whole, we don't focus on, you know, current issues so much because, you know, there is that risk, unlike a newspaper, where we could be out of date before we even come out. So, as you say, sort of longer form features or interviews tend to be the way that we go.
And, you know, I was going to ask as well, who is your reader? I mean, is it more kind of a subscriber, or is it that kind of person that just go to W.H. Smith, grab a copy of the magazine? How is that division like for 442?
I think it's an interesting question. It's actually something that we've looked at more during lockdown because we were slightly worried. But because obviously with shops shut initially, I mean, it was only supermarkets and convenience stores, I think, that were open at one point. You know, the likes of WH Smith, as you mentioned, being shut for quite a long period. But sales held up pretty well during that period. But also we saw subscriptions rise, especially during June and July. So I think it's pretty fair to say it's a mix. I mean, there are still those people who will go and buy it on the newsstand every month, but then there are people who realise that actually it's probably a better deal to get a subscription. And so, you know, those two avenues have been performing pretty well during the last few months, I have to say.
Well, that's fantastic to hear. And James, I was reading, I mean, there are other international editions of 442. I mean, how close do you work with those other editions of the magazine?
Particularly closely. I mean, the one's just launched over, I think earlier this year, over in Turkey. And we do hear from them every now and again. And I think that they use some of the content that we produce if it's relevant to them. But as editorial teams, we don't deal with them too much. I think you'll find that it'll be more the sort of licensing teams and maybe the ad teams who are more in touch. But as editorial, I don't think we're necessarily in touch. What we might do is, for example, you know, talking about the European Championships, which will hopefully now be next summer, if we needed somebody on a certain country and there was a 442 magazine in that country, then I think that we could go to somebody at that magazine and say, would you mind writing something for us, you know, for the English edition? And you know, it makes sense for them to us to go to them rather than anybody else. But there's not a huge link editorially, I would say. Not from our side anyway.
Are you excited now the Premier League's going ahead and things, you know, I think most countries, they kind of returned, I wouldn't say to normal, but, you know, there has been a return to football finally.
Yeah, I think this weekend, I think, was, in my mind, we needed to get to this weekend because it does feel more normal. Obviously, it came back in, when was it, end of June, early July for the sort of restart, but that really did feel like a restart and it was just about getting through it and finishing it. With this being the start of the new season, and not just the Premier League and the Championship, but, you know, we saw Leagues 1 and 2 return, I think that, as you say, it's not normal yet. Fans aren't in the ground, although I've just read that Football League clubs may be allowed to have 1,000 fans this weekend. It feels more normal than it did a couple of months ago. Plus, September is when league football should be played, not necessarily July. So, yeah, we're getting there, I think. And, you know, we've got the season mapped out. We know that, you know, it started last weekend and we finish at the end of May and then we go into the Euros. And so, touch wood, everything's sort of okay and we can carry on, then there'll be no more disruptions.
That was James Andrew from 442 Magazine. Their new issue will be out on Wednesday, the 26th of September. Well, that's it for this week's show. My thanks to our editor, Nora Hull. And if you have any comments or queries, feel free to write to me, Fernando, at fp@monaco.com. And remember, we're back next Saturday at the same time. And of course, meanwhile, you can always listen to it again at monaco.com or subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and SoundCloud. And before we go, a little song for you. Alex Capranos and Clara Luciani with Summer Wine. You've been listening to The Stack. I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Until next time, it's goodbye from me. Mon vin d'été a toutes ses saveurs.